Antes de comenzar con este episodio, recuerda que lo tienes con subtítulos en castellano en mi canal de YouTube, con el mismo título. Si no sabes cuál es mi canal de YouTube, lo tienes todo en jimenadelaserna.com. Recuerda que Jimena es con X. Bienvenida de nuevo a un episodio de nuestro podcast Viaje a la Nueva Historia. Uno muy especial en donde vamos a estar explorando la vida de Charles Dowding, una de las personas que más quería entrevistar para nuestro podcast. Un verdadero pionero en la jardinería orgánica desde hace más de 40 años. Vamos a descubrir cómo sus innovadoras técnicas han revolucionado la forma en que cultivamos alimentos en casa y cuidamos de nuestro entorno y nuestro cuerpo. Prepárate para un viaje lleno de sabiduría y conocimiento y además uno en el que Charles se soltó la melena con nosotros. Charles Dowding es un reconocido autor y horticultor que ha dejado o que está dejando una huella imborrable en la jardinería orgánica. Su enfoque revolucionario de no labrar la tierra y priorizar la salud del suelo está desafiando las prácticas convencionales. A través de años de experimentación y observación meticulosa, Dowding ha desarrollado métodos que fomentan ecosistemas prósperos y cosechas abundantes sin dañar nuestro medio ambiente. Sus valiosos conocimientos y sabiduría se han difundido a través de sus aclamados libros y artículos, inspirando a jardineros de todas partes del mundo, yo incluida. Desde técnicas de compostaje hasta la rotación de cultivos, Dowding ha compartido sus secretos para un cultivo sostenible y regenerativo. Sus enseñanzas desafían completamente la idea de que la jardinería, para poder sacar nuestro propio alimento, debe ser complicada y demuestran que una conexión profunda con la naturaleza y el suelo es clave para el éxito. Además de su enfoque práctico, Charles ha sido y es un defensor apasionado de la conservación de la biodiversidad y la promoción de hábitats saludables para las plantas y los animales en nuestro jardín. Su mensaje nos recuerda la importancia de vivir en armonía con la naturaleza y cómo nuestras acciones individuales tienen ese efecto dominó que pueden tener un impacto positivo en todo el mundo que nos rodea. Así que en este episodio te invito a sumergirte en el fascinante mundo de Charles Dowding, literalmente en su casa y en su huerto, donde la pasión por la horticultura se mezcla con la ciencia y la sabiduría ancestral. Prepárate para descubrir nuevas formas de cultivar, aprender sobre los beneficios de la no labranza y explorar los secretos de un suelo saludable en lugar de concentrarnos en fertilizantes. Es hora de inspirarnos, amiga, y comenzar a cultivar en armonía con la naturaleza de manos de un hermano de verdad de esta tribu. En su historia La reunión de la tribu, el autor Charles Eisenstein adelantaba que, en el momento de mayor crisis humana, la tribu se encontraría unos a otros para comenzar la historia del nuevo mundo. El metaverso, el Matrix, nunca ha vivido una crisis siquiera comparable a la que estamos viviendo. Es el momento del derrumbe total y el comienzo del nuevo mundo. Por lo menos, es nuestra responsabilidad comenzarlo. Como el arcano de la torre en tarot, la destrucción no es fácil, pero es necesaria para el nuevo comienzo. ¿Cómo transitar por esta hecatombe juntos, con humildad y compasión, para que esta crisis no sea el fin, sino el principio? Eso es de lo que se trata este podcast. Bienvenida a Viaje a la Nueva Historia, la reunión de la tribu. Te estábamos esperando. Esta charla, porque es una charla, no es una entrevista realmente, va a ser un poquito más larga de lo normal, pero de verdad que merece muchísimo el tiempo, sobre todo por el invitado que tenemos. Alguien muy especial que estaba arriba de mi lista de personas que quería entrevistar. Si no conoces a Charles, ajústate el cinturón porque vas a un viaje espectacular y si ya lo conocías, igualmente, relájate para escuchar a un alma gemela de esta tribu. Dicen por ahí que no debes conocer a tus ídolos porque corres el riesgo de que se te caigan del pedestal. Yo pienso que no hay que subir a nadie en un pedestal, pero que cuando estamos bien conectados con nuestro instinto, somos capaces de darnos cuenta de dónde hay un alma gemela y cuando vas y la buscas y la encuentras, te das cuenta de que tu instinto no te fallaba. Si no sabes, yo tengo un blog también donde están todos mis episodios del podcast con texto extra y recursos extra. Así que si de cualquiera de mis temas quieres saber más, solo tienes que ir a mi blog, que lo vas a encontrar en jimenadelaserna.com. Lo buscas con el mismo título y vas a encontrar mucho más texto y recursos para cada uno de los episodios. Y es eso lo que te quiero leer aquí. Creo que esta es una buena introducción para un episodio que es para mí muy especial. Y quiero que no se quede nadie sin leer o sin escuchar esa narración que pongo al principio en el blog. Así que te la voy a leer aquí para adentrarnos en el mundo de Charles Darwin y en una conversación que fue muy, muy especial. A micrófono cerrado me contó cosas que es mejor dejar privadas, pero no se van a quedar con ganas de ver a este gran maestro llamar abiertamente a las cosas por su nombre, hablar de lo que está pasando realmente con el clima y la manipulación, y lo más importante, compartirnos todas las prácticas que él lleva a cabo y que son técnicas olvidadas, o más bien que han querido que olvidemos, que no recordemos o que ridiculicemos. El 10 de junio de 2023 no podía contener mi emoción mientras Mark y yo nos adentrábamos en el hermoso jardín de Charles Darwin en Somerset, al día siguiente de haber llegado desde Alemania por carretera. He estado siguiendo su trabajo durante años, estudiando sus libros y viendo sus vídeos con una admiración inquebrantable. Ahora tenía la increíble oportunidad de asistir a uno de sus talleres e incluso entrevistarlo para mi podcast. Y por si fuera poco, Charles nos había invitado a Mark y a mí a ir a verlo en la mañana del taller antes de que llegara todo el mundo. Esta aventura empezaba increíble. Al entrar al jardín quedé inmediatamente cautivada por la exuberante vegetación y los vibrantes colores de las hortalizas, increíblemente grandes para una época tan temprana del año. A su lado las mías eran apenas plántulas. El aire estaba impregnado del dulce aroma de la tierra que caracteriza al Reino Unido y del sonido de los pájaros cantando, creando una atmósfera serena que proporcionaba el escenario para un día de aprendizaje. La conexión personal fue inmediata. Supe que había conocido a un alma hermana en el viaje a la nueva historia. Mark y yo lo ayudamos a pelar habas para el almuerzo. A media mañana comenzó el taller y Charles Darwin se situó frente a nosotros compartiendo su sabiduría y pasión por la jardinería orgánica. Su presencia tranquila y conocedora resonaba en todos los presentes. Mientras hablaba, podía sentir su profunda conexión con el suelo y las plantas, y su compromiso con las prácticas sostenibles se reflejaban en cada palabra. El enfoque de Darwin en el método sin labranza, la importancia de la salud del suelo y el poder del compostaje resonaban profundamente en mí. Sus métodos no son solo efectivos, sino que también están alineados con nuestros valores de sostenibilidad y cuidado del medio ambiente. Los de verdad, no los de las agendas de quienes ya sabemos. Al día siguiente del taller, tuve el increíble privilegio de entrevistar a Charles. De ahí esta charla. Honestamente, en este punto ya nos sentíamos como viejos amigos que se reencuentran tras una vida, nunca mejor dicho, separados. En total honestidad con ustedes, me sentía de verdad conmovida. Además de maravillada por la genuina humildad de este ser humano y su deseo de compartir conocimiento que nos hacen libres. Esos conocimientos que tanto se empeñan en que olvidemos. Por supuesto, tenía que ser Acuario. En este episodio Charles se soltó la melena, tribu. Yo ya sospechaba que Charles era uno de los nuestros, un alma sabia y con los ojos muy abiertos. Alguien tachado de loco desde temprano en su vida cuando comenzó a utilizar prácticas que nada tenían que ver con el mainstream y que además tenían éxito. A micrófono cerrado me contó cosas que es mejor dejar privadas, pero no se van a quedar con ganas de ver a este gran maestro llamar abiertamente a las cosas por su nombre, hablar de lo que está pasando realmente con el clima y la manipulación, y lo más importante, compartirnos todas las prácticas que él lleva a cabo y que son técnicas olvidadas, o más bien que han querido que olvidemos, que no recordemos o que ridiculicemos. La única verdad es que digan lo que digan, Charles logra una exuberancia en su cosecha y a una velocidad que sería de necios ignorar. Al final de la entrevista sentí un profundo agradecimiento por la honestidad y apertura con la que Charles nos había obsequiado, ya que él no ha tocado abiertamente estos temas hasta ahora. Por eso esta entrevista es algo inédito. Al dejar el jardín de Darwin ese día, llevaba conmigo un renovado sentido de propósito por compartir el conocimiento que había adquirido. Sabía que sus enseñanzas continuarían modelando mi trayectoria y sabía que había rellenado un huequito más en ese casillero en mi corazón de almas a las que estoy buscando. Hay algo en mí que lucha por encajar en los grupos sociales. Me resulta difícil, en parte porque sigo cuestionando las creencias comúnmente aceptadas y las suposiciones ocultas. Charles Darwin. Ahora sí, disfruta de esta charla con Charles.
This is a dream of mine and of many, many of our followers, our viewers. They were so happy to know that I was coming to see you. So thank you so much, Charles, for being here today and for welcoming us in your house.
Oh, well, it's such a pleasure, actually. I can't quite believe you're here.
Really?
Yeah, because I've been following you as well. And it's like, wow.
This is really weird because yesterday I was telling Mark that I felt a bit like I was jumping into the Matrix because obviously I've seen you for many years on the YouTube. And then suddenly it's like I crossed a barrier and I jumped into YouTube and now it's real. It's like I jumped inside of another dimension.
Great. Oh, so, well, I hope we can make it real for your viewers.
Yeah, I hope so. And if you want to make it real as well, know that Charles does seminars and courses almost every weekend during the summer, right? And that's what we were doing yesterday. We came to one of his courses. And even though I've watched, I don't know how many hours of your videos, probably thousands of hours of your videos, I have few of your books, I have two of your online courses, I still learned a lot of things yesterday that I didn't know.
So. And it was really good energy, wasn't it, in that group of people? Exactly. That's something I really like. You really pick it up. It's something I noticed after lockdown finished, mm-hmm. that even though we could do a lot of online work together with people all over the world, mm-hmm. I did a course in Inverness in Scotland with mm-hmm. 18 people in the room, and the energy, I'd not felt it for so long. It's like, oh.
Right after the restrictions.
Yeah, soon after lockdown. It was the first sort of group course I'd done for quite a while.
And all the people were like...
There was a buzz in the air. And I think that you get that feeling with a group of people together. Sadly, we can't get it quite online. But actually, just the two of us, I think, we can buzz off each other.
Absolutely.
And send that energy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yesterday, yeah. actually, when we met for the first time, it was like... It really felt like you're coming yeah. to someone you already know. Yeah. And it's like, hey, Charles, long time no see you. And then yeah. we were just talking about a lot of interesting things.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know. How does it happen nowadays? Obviously, you've been doing this for 40 years. So that's how old I am almost. I'm 39 years old. So you started doing this when I was born. And so you know how things were before. I still remember the world when there was no internet, no connection. Internet didn't arrive until I was a well-grown up teenager. So I remember not having mobile phones, not having internet, not having other ways to connect. And obviously you remember that better than I do. Yeah. And now with this intercommunication globally, do you not think it's amazing that even though we're not meeting people face to face, we're still matching people who
connected
are kindred spirits.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I was just going to say that, actually, because I'm really grateful for it. In my life, I felt quite isolated sometimes from having unusual views, different to the mainstream. And I feel that through the internet, much more connected now with people all over the world. And, you know, that's actually meeting you is amazing. But people like you and loads of your viewers, I'm sure, great to see you. And, yeah. You know, we want to share some unusual things, don't we, a bit? And
this is so interesting, Charles, because one of the things my followers complain, quote unquote, complain to me the most. I do a live session with them every week for, I don't know, 5-6 years. I've been doing every single week. I do 1 hour live with everyone who wants to join.
Cool.
And probably the number one thing that comes up every time is people telling me I feel isolated, like my friends don't understand me. My children think I'm crazy. My husband thinks I've lost it. And I don't find friends. I always say to them, this is just the beginning. Because something, I don't know if you know the author, Charles Eisenstein. This is the other Charles of my life.
Yeah. I've heard of him. I don't know much about him, actually.
Yeah, I think you will love his books. And he's absolutely amazing. And one thing that he says is that you cannot change something without changing everything else. Meaning, one day you change the way you eat, and 5 years later, that's a domino effect. You are divorcing, moving home, moving countries, and finding a new group of people in another part of the world. A domino
Still
effect.
I don't get that, though. So what he's saying, though, is that you've got to just do the changes you feel are right to do, and other things
Follow. I think this the thing what it means, or what it means to me, I think, yeah, that's what it means, is like you change one little thing.
Yeah.
Like, for example, you start growing your own veggies.
Yeah. That can change more than you expect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not just, okay, I'm going to grow my own veggies and then everything else stays the same. It never happens.
Well, it's something I'm coming to appreciate more and more, even having been doing it for so long, is that growing your own food does have a lot of effects that you wouldn't expect. And health is probably the... Health and brain, that whole thing, even now we're only just discovering, well, we scientists are only just discovering the connection between the soil biome and the gut biome.
It's which we knew already.
We knew already, but it's useful to have that kind of framework of language to talk about it. And that is so empowering, because that means if you're growing your own food, you are connecting to the soil and earth energy and getting that in you. And then learning also about how the gut is so connected to the brain, part of the brain. Well, we knew that already, but I find myself, actually, I'm sure I'm mentally more clear than I was 10 years ago, even though I'm getting older. I'm 64 now, and I feel 24.
Yes.
I don't look 24, but you know, I just
but
feel...
But you don't look 64.
I feel good energy, but I do feel that clarity. And that's important. We really need that now, because we're bombarded with lies, basically,
with lies,
to put it in a word.
Yeah. And I think the more... Was it so evident that so many things were a lie 40 years ago?
To me?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I grew up in a very conventional, normal family and, you know, lovely people. But I never felt quite right about a lot of things. But it wasn't, I still trusted my government. I thought they were doing the best for me. And I trust Britain. I thought I hate to say it now, but I thought the British Empire was a good thing, because that's what I'd been taught in school, all this kind of thing. And I've just been unlearning that all my life. But it took me a long time. It wasn't really until lockdown, that was what really hit me the hardest, that I could see, well, it enabled me to see more clearly the pattern of lies behind most of what we're told, and how most of us are being... I was going to say forced, but it's not quite like that. But given so much false information that most people just don't realise. One of my favourite sayings is Goethe. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know him.
Yeah. Another German.
None are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free.
Damn.
It's a bit shocking, isn't it?
None are more
hopelessly enslaved.
That those who believe they're free.
And I think, because that's what I believe, that most people now think they're free, and they're a lot less free than they realise, because they've been so conditioned that they haven't got free choice anymore. They're just kind of almost behaving robot-like.
But they think they do.
Yeah, they think they're choosing all their life and their reality. It's been chosen for them.
This is... I think this is very well summarized in a meme that goes around, which is a horse. That it's a horse, so, you know, a horse is a force of power. And the little horse, or the big horse, is just being tied, not even tied. His rope is just around the chair, like this. So it's very light. He could just, like, walk away. But his belief is that because he is chained, he cannot move.
Right. Yeah, that's very similar.
He's hopelessly enslaved.
Yeah.
But he thinks he's free. He doesn't realise. He could just like...
Wow. These are good, actually, aren't they? These little sort of parables that help us to see more clearly, hopefully. There's one more I'll just mention. Is Krishnamurti said, it's no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society.
Yes, this is a very famous one. This is a very famous one. And it's one that Charles Eisenstein... It talks about in one of his books, I can't remember which one, probably The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible.
Yep.
Just think about this title. I think you will like it. And he says, he mentions that when he says, so we're sending our children to school and the better they do in school, is that actually a good thing? Yeah. Or does it mean that they are more adjusted to a system that is completely sick?
Yeah, well, actually, I did really well in school.
I did amazing at school. And then it makes me think about it. Yeah. I'm like, damn, I was really good at school.
Yeah, it just means we've had a lot to unlearn.
A lot to unlearn. I think the more the better you were at school, the more you have to unlearn. And those children that were like super revolutionary in school, they're probably more free or...
Yeah. Actually, my middle son was a bit like that. He never got on in school. And he's now runs a farming business. actually he has two diggers. It's ironic, but the farming he's doing himself for his own part is very sympathetic to the soil. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who made that lovely sign that we've got there.
The no dig.
Yeah, and when he gave that to me, I was blown away because I didn't know he was interested in that. You know, he's always been digging.
Did he find the gold? The thing I think also, Charles, is that sometimes, and I always say this to our followers, because they tell me, especially when they say, my family think I'm crazy because I've changed the way I eat, because I don't believe in the agendas that they believe in, because I was against the lockdowns, whatever, my family think I'm crazy. How can I bring my family into what I'm doing? And I always say, don't do anything. Just live your life.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Be true to yourself.
Be true to yourself.
And the rest will follow.
And then
it's a bit like what
you don't
saying.
Know. Exactly. Yeah. Then you don't know and your child is actually listening.
Yeah.
Even though you think they're not.
And a lot of other people too.
And a lot of other people too.
You know, that's why I feel grateful for social media. I've realised that there are a lot of people out there who want to know this stuff. Mm-hmm. And actually, the mainstream media, which actually I like to call the legacy media, they keep a lid on it. When I won a prize for, with Steph, we won a prize for the book No Dig Organic Home and Garden. That was in 2017.
That book's amazing.
Thank you.
That book's amazing.
So it's a big event in the Smart Hotel in London, the Savoy Hotel, and the winners were announced for the book, and we went up to collect the prize and happened to walk past the table where all the journalists and the editor of the Daily Telegraph Gardening, that's a really big British newspaper.
Yeah, of course.
We're sitting, and the editor, who I know a bit, I don't really know well, but it was just so funny what she said. She went like this, "You win."
No.
It's like, well, what do you mean? Is this a kind of like a war or a competition? No. And it felt then, it kind of explained, because it seemed to me I'd often been trying to get mainstream media, the big media, to publish stories about No Dig, I wouldn't say there was never any interest, but they weren't that keen really. But it just seemed to me like this is so clear that it can benefit so many people. It's going to save people a lot of time. It's in the end, it's going to be, they're going to be producing a lot more food for less effort.
And that's why they don't want it.
That? Well, I'm afraid so. You know, that's when you start to think, what's going on here?
The more independent you are, the more sovereignty you have.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't want their readers to be too independent.
Exactly.
You
could, but that's not good for the system. That brings me back, and it's related to some of the things that we're going to be seeing in your garden in a minute, because we're going to be going around and Charles is going to tell us a little bit about the myths of gardening. There must be something beyond of our understanding, because like we said at the beginning of the interview, back in the 80s, the 90s, we had to meet people face to face to connect. Mm-hmm. And how is it that now we are connecting even though we don't know the people face to face? So there has to be a field of energy that is beyond our understanding that brings us together, because how can that be?
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of it like that.
How can it be that I come to meet you and we already had the connection? Or it happens to me all the time when I go and meet people that I've met online and the connection is already there, without having known each other from before, and we've never touched, we've never seen each other in real life, yet the connection is there.
Ah, well, we're both Aquarians.
Well, this is, I don't know if you, if you follow a lot of that, but there's always these memes about Aquarians going like, oh, this is the aliens, and we are very like, we like to think beyond.
On the edge.
On the edge. And if you want on the edge, or a little bit beyond the edge.
Yeah, no, it's great. That's where the internet, though, can be really good, making these connections. I think, like we're doing now, we can build on it once you've got that contact.
So I would say, don't worry if you feel like you've done one change and you feel isolated, right? You will find your tribe.
Yeah, well, do you know, it's a funny thing with, like, No Dig, because how I have connected with so many people through that, and then I get a lot of messages of people saying, like, you have really changed my life. It's like, what?
I know.
I mean, it's really nice though, isn't it? And it's more than a method. And that's going, you know, to the myth thing. And what I love about it is it can lead people to question and take them down that path. You know, coming back to, again, to that same thing, you change one thing. And in this case, it's how you tend your soil. And it's leading to so many others. Mm. And that's what more encourages me more than anything, actually. Because I think there is then this ripple effect of it spreading out And that's what I'm really hoping with my work is, back in the 80s, I was in the Soil Association, in the Organic Growers Association. We had in those days, I was treasurer of the Organic Growers Association. Mm. We thought we could change the world by having these organizations and getting people together and talking and persuading people that, look, organic is the way to go and this kind of thing. Never happened. And then we'd sort of get, even government ministers sometimes would graciously come and give a talk at one of our events, you know, the Minister for Agriculture. And it's like, oh, and we're all really polite to him, you know, yeah, yeah, nice to meet you. And they'd make promises and you think, great. And then nothing happened. And I've seen this happen so often. It's more than a pattern. It's just how things are. Top down does not work in our Western society, at least. And if you go, a lot of people are spending energy trying to do that. But I've realized, and that's where the social media is so wonderful, to connect with millions of people, actually. That can build an energy. And I think all of us are really, you know, go for it, really changing more than we realize.
This is so interesting. What you just said, top down doesn't work.
Yeah.
I always say this, and so many people wasting the energy. Energy is...
Yeah, talking to government, you know.
Talking to government, trying to change them so they change things. Yeah. No, change it yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be the change you want to see.
And just acknowledge, you know, that's what it's taken me a while to realize, that government doesn't want to benefit us. You know, that's a bit of a generalization. I'm not saying all government, people in government are bad, but the underlying... reality is that's what it is, and that again, that's what I saw really clearly in lockdown. All those measures were so harmful to so many people, and they were so lied about, and all the statistics were manipulated. You know, suddenly people were dying of COVID, and actually it was just flu. In Britain, it was something like 20,000 people normally die of flu every year, and during that lockdown year, hardly any did.
Yeah, no. Why would they? Yeah.
So, you know, it's just that. It really opens your eyes to see, yeah, how much things are being manipulated. So
I think 2020 really opened our eyes to the ones of us who were on the edge of opening our eyes.
Yeah.
And the ones of us who were completely blind still, and well, some people still didn't open their eyes. That's interesting also because, you know, we entered the era of Aquarius very recently in the 2000s.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And it all goes together. It's suddenly the opening of the eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, but I feel that most people...
Most people still didn't.
Sleeping, really. Mm-hmm. That's tragic. But do they not want to wake up? Or is it just that they're lacking some spark of something, information or realization?
You know what I think? I also think a lot of people, some people are very good at, okay, I was wrong, I'm going to change the way I think. Okay, this didn't work, let's change it. Mm. But for other people, acknowledging that you were wrong all the time or that you were lied to, not even wrong, but you were lied to, that things are not the way you thought. Yeah. Sometimes it's not just pride, because it could be pride that, oh no, how could I admit that I am wrong sometimes? But sometimes could be also scary, right?
Yeah.
Like, does that mean then that I'm on my own? That there is no daddy?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, you're right. Of course, it can take you out of your social context as well. And your friends and family, yeah, like you were saying. No, that's true. But it's going back to No Dig again, you know, it's definitely the case in the gardening world that I think that's why there's been so much resistance to this completely novel approach, because it's kind of making wrong a lot of what was being taught before. I mean, not that that's my aim, and I'm really careful not to, I don't want to ever put pressure on people, I don't want to make them feel bad about what they were doing for. I'm not even saying it's wrong, but just realising... keeping positive about it. Look, there's a better way here, and just move forward.
I would say it's like you didn't know better. When you don't know better, you don't do better. But when you know better, then you can do
and
better.
Just embrace it.
Yeah. If you didn't know it, it's okay. You didn't know.
Yeah, exactly.
So don't feel guilty. Yeah. Don't feel ashamed. Don't feel anything. It's just like, oh, now I know better. Okay, let's do this.
Yeah.
Let's try something.
And all of that actually is helped by this thing of growing your own food in healthy soil, because you are getting those microbes. Yeah. Your brain is starting to get clear, and everything, you know, I think that's where the life-changing moments come from, because it all slots into place.
So this is what I mean. You start by not digging and you end up opening your eyes about everything else.
Yeah.
So shall we have a look about what No Dig can do And before we do that, I know most of our viewers know who you are and what you do and what No Dig is. But just to start the tour on the garden, what is No Dig and why is it so revolutionary?
It's okay, so no dig means you are leaving soil undisturbed. That's the essence of it. It's not like a religious statement, you know, so you because people ask me on YouTube and say, okay, with no dig, how do I plant an apple tree? It's like, well, you take
you
a spade and dig a hole,
you know,
so that,
yes.
That is allowed. So it's that thing of, you know, when it's appropriate. So random digging just because you think it's good, you know, people have been told it's good, that just no point, forget that. And then the other thing is feeding soil life. So it's about working with biology. This is quite a big step in a way, because if you follow it right through, you're switching from thinking of plant growth through chemistry, which is how the debate has been phrased, nutrients feeding plants, and instead you're feeding soil life with the organic matter on the surface, which I recommend mostly in the damp climates like here, it's compost. Mm. That's because it doesn't hold slugs. Mm-hmm. But for your viewers who are in hot, dry climates, then the surface mulch could be hay or straw, you know, anything. So you need to work out what's appropriate for you. But the principle is the surface application and maintenance of some organic matter, which is just copying nature, basically. It's like
nature.
What Victor Schauberger said, you know, copy nature and understand. It's just that.
Oh, I love it. I think this could be the headline of the interviews, like copy nature.
Yeah.
Something like that, like copy nature and see what happens.
But then we need to acknowledge that, mm-hmm. you know, in nature, we would not find this.
That's right.
We would not find a lovely row of peas or a bed of carrots or tomatoes growing. Well, you might find some wild tomatoes. But so that's where actually growing vegetables is, you need the specialist knowledge and certain skills. And that's what I want to share and I'm always teaching. So it's underpinned by the soil treatment, which is very minimal. And that links back to why it's revolutionary a bit is, I think it's not realized because a lot of people are doing this digging, say, without realizing it's based on certain assumptions. And one of the assumptions is that man runs nature. Man has dominion over nature, you know, like it's taught in the Bible. So soil, we can improve soil by forking it, digging it,
by
loosening
force.
It, aerating
force.
It. Yeah, force, by man applying. I'm saying man here, but I think most of your viewers will know what I mean, people. And then, you know, you're improving soil. And it's almost like your duty as a person on earth, you know, because that's what God said, you know, that kind of thing.
And work the land.
Yeah, so no dig, you're stepping back from that and not involving yourself. You're acknowledging that soil can do it itself and that all the soil life can sort itself out. And, you know, that some people could see that as disempowering because they feel, oh, then what am I going to do? It doesn't give me a role anymore. But our role actually is we can really enable that process. And there's many other really interesting ways that we can enable it even more, ways that modern science doesn't even acknowledge, you know, like the hidden energies that you get in biodynamics, for example. And I can mention a few more if you want.
We're going to be showing some biodynamics things that Charles does.
And more.
And more. And much more. So No Dig really links with biodynamic, really links with permaculture.
Yeah, all of those.
It's all.
But it's kind of an all embracing it up. I sometimes actually get frustrated by people who talk about permaculture mm-hmm. in a very, as though it's a very defined thing. Because mm-hmm. for me, permaculture actually is really common sense.
It's common sense.
You know, and if you're not careful, you get a rule book. Oh, is this permaculture or is not? You know, and then people worry that they're doing the right or wrong thing.
Because people like to follow rules.
Yeah, they really do. And that's, I'm always trying to strip that away. And that's why I say no dig is so simple. Leave the soil undisturbed where appropriate and feed the surface. That's it. You know, there's lots of other little things you can do around that and take it a bit further or differently, but that is it. And you know, I don't want to create a big code of practice.
No.
Or a movement which is enshrined in rules and has a committee.
A recipe book.
You know, and I'm the emperor of no dig. You know, people say, why don't you start a no dig, I don't know, movement, is if that's quite the right word, but worldwide organisation. Ah, no.
No.
that would be death, really, because that solidifies it. And, you know, I think that's the problem, actually, hope people don't mind me saying, but with biodynamics, you've got all these associations and they get too codified, and then there's not room. I think Steiner would have preferred that people are more free to take it on from his teachings, that kind of thing.
humans really like to institutionalize things.
Yeah, exactly.
We like it. We like to put things in books and rules,
yeah.
And it's not very Aquarian.
Yeah.
And I think that's why you say, why don't you? No!
Yeah.
No!
Yeah.
We prefer that. No, just spread the knowledge and do
and
it.
Share it.
And
yeah.
share it.
Yeah.
So I would say this is interesting. This is feed the soil. Don't feed the plant.
Yeah.
Feed the soil.
Which really means feed the soil life.
Feed the soil, feed life.
Yeah, feed life. And then the life will sort things out. You know, like we know the mycorrhizal network of filaments in the soil, that all the fungi help plant roots to find the moisture and food they need. So when you realize that, you know, can see it's just a crime to put a fork or spade in the soil because you're breaking up all that life structure and then it has to restart. I've actually got beds over there where we're doing a trial where one bed we put a fork in just to loosen the soil, not even do a proper digging. We don't invert it or anything. And it has the compost on top, same as the bed next to it, which is no dig. And the bed with that we fork is noticeably poor in growth, and most of the vegetables, not all actually, but it's very interesting just seeing those comparisons. And you realise and you think, well, you know, why has this been thought to be good? I mean, really, why? Why has this been thought to be good?
Just because it's been told through so many years.
Yeah, well, it must be that.
It must be that,
because where's the evidence?
Yeah, because also when you are digging, you are disturbing seeds and then you get more weeds. And then many people say to me, I cannot do no dig because I have a lot of weeds. I say, no, that's perfect. That's exactly what you need.
Yeah.
And that then, you know, hopefully, if anyone, I think that again, that's where no dig can really trigger the thought process in your mind. If you start to think, well, why did I do that then? Why was I believing before that I had to dig and fork the soil or whatever? And then think about other bits of your life where this also overlaps. You know, like the bread we had yesterday for lunch, no need.
No need. and no fill. Also, when Charles puts the little seedlings into the earth, he just makes a hole with a dibber, which I bought because he designed it and it's amazing. And he just makes a hole and then he takes the little seedling, he pops it in, press down and leaves it and doesn't fill it in. So
job done. Yeah.
That's it. No, not fill, no dig, no need.
And a lot of it for me is about time saving.
Yeah.
Because the more time we have, the more free we are to be creative and, you know, just expand our knowledge and do things better and grow more food, whatever it might be.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Change the world.
Well, I wasn't going to say that.
Connect with more people online. That's another thing about you, Charles. Before we go into the garden, I don't want to take too much of your time, but at the beginning, when I started following you, I thought he must have a huge crew of people answering all his messages and comments and everything. And then the more I follow you, I realized, no, this is Charles responding.
No, it is me. Well, I have just recently, in the last 3 months, I've employed a social media manager. And she is helping with some answering the questions that are not too technical. But she'll just leave the ones that need a bit of extra knowledge to me. But apart from that, I do it all. And yeah, I get up early. But I really appreciate the connection, actually, and that I've learned a lot from it, from doing that. And so keep the questions coming.
Keep the questions coming. Let's go and see the garden, shall we?
Yeah.
Let's go and see your trial beds that you were talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And these are my, not my main dig, no dig trial, actually, which is also we could look at later maybe if we have time. But these are the ones where instead of digging, I just do forking of the soil. So we put a fork in once a year. And just pull it enough to loosen the soil.
Okay, and then you can see a difference.
And
you
that's
can.
This bed here. In fact, it's all the beds in this strip going up to the blue water bud at the end. And they're all sown or planted with the same vegetables at the same time, and they're all harvested at the same time, then we weigh the harvest. So we've got record, and I've been doing, this is the 10th year of doing this trial. So I've got 9 years of results. And it's showing so far is that 8% less food where you do this forking.
8% just by forking, not even turning.
Yeah, by doing this extra work.
By doing more work, you get less food.
You get 8%
oh, great.
Less food. And it's the same compost, same everything, just the forking. And this year, for some reason, it's visually often not very visible. So you they look quite similar. You pick the leaves, and when you weigh them, these just weigh less. It's like, what is this? And I've had people who are working here saying the same thing. But they look the same. When we put them on the scales, there's just not so much matter, nutrition. You know, that's what I wonder. So anyway, you look at these lettuce here. So this is in the fork bed. We've picked these 5 times already. That's why they're medium sized, but they've been in the ground since March. So for over 2 months. And then look at those on the no-dig bed.
It's very visible.
It's quite striking, particularly the middle row.
The middle row of cos.
Yeah.
They're huge in that bed.
Yeah.
Even the curly ones. I mean, I think you can see it in all of them.
But actually, now you say the Batavians, these are caught up a bit. They were more behind. Because I think probably the soil is healing itself a bit. But basically, these again look quite similar, that row of Batavians.
Well, your soil is so good way more. That even the bad soil heals itself.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank goodness.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. It is very visible.
And then, while we're here, actually, yeah, of course, we've got this trial. We've got here, look, Jimena. This bed of potatoes. Well, I call it a bed. It's a line, if you like, because there's three little beds of it. But what I'm doing here is no rotation trial.
Oh, that's another thing.
Yeah. So, that you know, four-year rotation.
Yes.
Gospel.
Yes.
You must follow
yes,
the
is.
Four-year
if
rotation.
If not, then God is going to and finish everything off.
So this is the 9th year of growing potatoes
in the same strip, ground. The same bed, in the same ground. No rotation. And you can see.
The average is this amount. To give your viewers an idea, it's quite nice if they can see the whole line there. It's 6 meters of bed by 1.2 meters wide. We get on average 44 kilos of potatoes.
44 kilos of potatoes.
And
from
last year,
wow!
Last year, which was year 8 of growing, 58 kilos. The weather was favorable. But
well,
even
yeah,
so, the plants
potatoes.
Were super healthy. And something else I'm doing is I'm saving my own, using my own seed potato.
This is something. What you were saying yesterday is that when you save your own seed, the vigor of the plants is uncanny.
Yeah.
It's like
often, as long as I've done it correctly.
Yeah.
I had some chard growing over there actually last year, and that chard seed I saved. Yeah, I've never seen chard grow like it before. Honestly, it's just blown me away. And normally growth is good here. Just makes you think, well, how good can it be?
Well, these beds, this is the thing. Today is the 11th of June. And one of the things that I was always complaining about with my guy complaining, it's like my plants compared to yours are like this big.
Smaller.
Yeah, much smaller. But everyone else was saying the same thing yesterday. They were saying, how come your garden looks like it's already July and mine looks like it's March? But he's been doing this for so many years. His soil is so healthy. And this is the thing about no-dig. It gets better and better.
It does. And I think also the energy things that I'm doing as well.
Let's look at
it. We can't measure it. Science can't measure it. That's why I can't say to your viewers, you know, like this, give them those sort of figures. But all you can say is, yeah, you look at this. Wow.
Let's look at the
but
energy.
I'll just quickly mention too, this is year 9 of broad beans as well in the same
bed,
and we've picked a lot of broad beans already.
We did yesterday.
And these, you know, a nice gardening tip here is these are going to be here not for very long, probably only one more week actually.
Yeah.
We'll do a final pick and then we cut the plants off at the ground, leave all the roots in there and plant kale. So we're getting 2 crops a year. And this is another beautiful thing with no-dig. It's so easy to do the succession planting because the ground's always ready, basically.
Yes.
You just pop new plants in.
Mark was asking me this morning, how much space do you think a couple or a small family need to eat? And I said, you know what? A space like this, well, a space like this can give you 40 kilos of potatoes, all of these beans, then kale, then
potatoes and leeks.
Potatoes and
they're
leeks.
They're only half a year.
And this, how big is this square that we're...
It's a trial area, basically. Yeah. And it's 6 meters from one... 6.5 meters, sorry, from one end to the other. And 9 meters from the edge to the concrete path.
So 6 by 9.
54 square meters.
It will give you...
A lot of food.
A lot of food.
If you look on my website, there's a page called Trials. And there's 3-strip trial, it's called. It's got all the figures, actually, for the last 9 years. Yeah. So you can see it all there.
You have to keep in mind that Charles sells his vegetables, so he needs a lot of them. But for a family, for 2 people.
Yeah.
Really, this is the size of a small garden in a house.
Yeah. And also, do you remember, like, yesterday how we ate the potatoes?
Yes.
And that was from harvest here 11 months ago.
We ate yesterday potatoes harvested 11 months ago.
Yeah.
And they were...
Just very simple, in a sack, in a shed. And I think that's because they're high quality food that you're harvesting and it's alive and it stores much better.
Because that's another thing, right? They say you have to store potatoes in boxes separated by 4 centimeters. Yeah. Don't touch each other. No, you just dump them in a bag.
Make it sound difficult and expensive, and that will keep you quiet.
Huh? it will keep you from not doing it. Yeah. Like they will. You won't just don't do it because I don't have the space to store 40 kilos of potatoes.
Yeah, or apples or whatever. It's just crazy, isn't it?
Wow. So let's see then.
Look, just talking about the energy. Yeah, this one here. I don't know what to call this little device, but it could be an energy tower, if you like. And it's based on the work of a scientist called Philip Callahan, who was an American. He traveled the world and he was really interested in pyramids, actually. But then he was also in Ireland. And I don't know if you know about them, but in Ireland, you've got these round towers that are really big, meters in diameter of solid walls and like 10 meters high. What are they? Nobody knows what they're doing. And he was looking at them on a map one night and that's the constellations of the Northern Hemisphere at winter solstice.
Oh my God.
Precisely mapped on Ireland.
Oh my God.
So it's like, that means something.
Of course it does.
This is what he worked out. He scaled down what their measurements. It's not exact, but enough that it, you see, I can't measure this, so I, that's why I hesitate to talk about it very much. But I'm sure this is having a good effect. In a few words, it's pulling low frequency energy from the universe and spreading it out in the ground.
It's like an antenna, right? It's got a quartz here.
Yeah, do you know what? That's my addition. That wasn't in his thing, but it feels like good. Yeah. But it's alternating layers of rock, dust, and wood chip, and it's
filled inside. This is like a pipe.
That's important. Yeah, that's some kind of electrical capacitance, I think it is, or some of your viewers will probably know better, that helps increase the energy.
And then it's like layers.
Yeah,
of soil,
rock dust, wood chip. It's just rock dust, volcanic rock, wood chip, basalt rock, wood chip, and so on, up to the top.
And then this chimney. Yeah. And did you build this?
This is just a drainage land pipe. Cost me £50. Yeah, that's what I love about all these things. This could be doing thousands of pounds worth of benefit. Probably more. They're not expensive.
No, of course not. But you have more of these things, right? Do you want to
show
us?
Let's see. Okay.
Charles is a very cautious person. This is something that I think is valuable about him. When he talks about something, you know that he's been trialing it for a long time and he's not just talking general BS.
I'm not comfortable talking about something that's very new to me.
Yeah, which is admirable.
Oh, thank you. I wonder if any of your viewers are familiar with this.
I think they are.
Apparatus. Yeah. Mm. Okay. So, as far as I understand, it stems from the work of Wilhelm Reich, and I would call it an organ generator, a generator of good energy, basically.
My followers know organites, and they're super into organites.
So we got a double-pointed quartz crystal at the bottom. So it's the way I understand it, it's pulling good energy from below and also spreading it out widely. I don't know how far. I don't know if anyone could measure that even, but what motivated me to make it was seeing all these chemtrails in the sky, which we've had quite big time since last autumn.
I know.
We didn't see, I gather you've had more, but we didn't see them much before.
No. I don't remember seeing so many here in the UK when I lived here. And obviously when I moved to Germany, it was the middle of COVID, so not a lot of planes were, but then suddenly after COVID, it's like sometimes we have grids, like it's actually made with a design.
And then you wonder what's falling out of the sky from
them
as well.
And then you wonder, and sometimes I think about that, like I said yesterday, and then you get rain, which is full of that, but then...
Here I've noticed that we're just getting much less really blue sky now than we used to. It's quite often hazy. Aeroplane flew over the other day and it wasn't very high, it wasn't doing that, but it was just, I could hardly see it. You know, the air has become quite opaque. Mm. Anyway, this, I've noticed it does seem to make more of a clearance above homemakers. So
last night it rained here and it didn't rain anywhere else in the area, so I just leave it there. This is just my thing. This is not Charles who said that, I say that.
and then here I'm doing, you know, I, like a lot of people, I got interested in this electroculture, and this is just one of my attempts. I want to make more of these because I had a dowser guy here with his rods, and he wasn't looking for anything particular, but he came on a course, actually, and afterwards he just went going around the garden because he loves dowsing. He's really good at it. And he said, what is this thing? He said, a lot of energy lines are flowing into it or from it or whatever. And he said he thinks it's changed some of the ley lines in the ground.
It can.
But what it's just copper wire. I use quite thick, 4 millimeter, but I think you could
put it thinner. Down in the earth.
Yeah, it's quite deep, 30 centimeters in the ground. Mm-hmm. I think it needs to be in contact with moisture to be effective at spreading the energy. Mm-hmm. And then up here, I mean, it's just me playing really, because I don't know if you have to coil it like that. Some people just have it straight up.
I think it makes it. I like the coiling. I think when I've seen things like this, it's always coiled.
Coil makes sense, doesn't it? It's kind of vortex energy.
Yeah. And Rudolf Steiner will always say that the straight lines don't work so well in nature. There's no straight lines. In nature.
Yeah, this is.
And in Germany, many people, it's something that I only knew in Germany. People plant, instead of in beds like this, they make,
spirals.
They call it spirals. So they make a spiral and then. And
but because for me, I don't get, you know, like in market gardening times, say you want to cover your plants against.
It's very difficult. I know. It makes things more difficult.
But have you heard of the Frenchman, Carbonneau, I think he's called, who wrote a booklet about this in the 1920s? He developed a quite sophisticated device for pulling in these energies and spreading them out in the ground. And I noticed in his booklet, you know, this was great stuff he was doing. Farmers, he said, have been using my devices to increase their planting hugely, and they're not needing to buy any fertilizer.
Yeah. Oh, well.
So he said that, and I thought, well, that's why he's disappeared off the map.
Exactly. Because then you don't have to buy anything.
We have to fight to, you know, to hang on to this knowledge. And I'm hesitating to say this stuff because, you know, I don't want to be deplatformed or anything.
No.
But having said that, I do want to share it as much as possible. And if you can certainly find out, there's a lot about this electroculture, isn't there?
Yeah. And I've seen it, I don't know who it was, but I've seen a video of probably the 50s or the 60s. It was many years ago and I can't remember how it was, but it was something to do with putting copper wires in the earth, making like lines that run across the beds. And they had a little charge with a little battery as well. And then they would have in beds to trial, and the difference was like 50%.
Wow.
But I can't remember where I saw these or who it was or how it was done. And I'm like, if anyone knows, because probably our viewers will know, if you know about this video, please link me to it because I want to see it again. I know it was something like this with wires and...
Right, something simple.
I think it was in Romania or somewhere like that. Yes. The rich people used to eat tomatoes out of pewter plates that
leaked... And that was what caused the poisoning.
Leaked lead.
Yeah.
Into the food,
yeah.
And they were eating lead. But the people who were poor and were eating out of wooden plates didn't get this problem.
Yeah, well, interesting. That links to, you know, Victor Schauberger, who I mentioned, that brilliant Austrian forester. And he was called in by the king of Bulgaria in 1930 could he help because their wheat harvests were declining. And Schauberger noticed that it was since they switched from wooden moldboard ploughs to iron. And it must be something to do with the iron. You know, this is quite big news for most modern farming because iron ploughs and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think he worked to add a copper plate, the ploughs or something, or even go back to wood, and then the yields went up again.
Too much iron in the
iron is not good for soil when it's moving. When it's moving through, particularly, it seems to break or damage the capillary structure of soil and its ability to hold on to water.
Yes.
So much relates to water, and you know what, there's a lot to find out about water still.
Water is like soil, is another of those things that have so much that we don't understand.
Yeah.
And how it works.
Yeah.
Something that you said yesterday that I thought it was fantastic is that so many of the myths, and this goes with what I teach and what I say also about illness of the body, is like so many myths about you cannot do this to a plant. Oh, it was about the pH of the soil. Exactly. It was like, don't plant this thing on here because the pH is bad, or you have to change the pH. First of all, it's almost impossible to change the pH because it will go back to what it is, right, eventually.
Yeah, exactly.
And what you said, which is amazing, is that how about we understand that the plant adapts itself rather than you have to adapt the surroundings of the plant.
Yeah, because that's what science is now discovering. You know, people with microscopes can see all the interactions of plant roots and how somehow they're working out to modify the pH around the root itself, even if the soil is officially not quite the right pH for the plant.
So the plant changes its environment to be able to thrive.
Plants are really clever.
This is amazing.
But this is where, you know, this is where I really have a beef with science.
I'm the same.
This bloody word.
I'm the same. And every time, like, I get people asking me, do you have a scientific study to prove that? And I said, you go find it, because you will find it. But I'm not gonna find it, because there's no point. Yeah. You will find studies for yes and for no, for black and for white and for everything in between.
But what does it mean?
But what does it mean?
Yeah, that's the question people need to ask.
Exactly. And what does it mean in a lab is not the same. Yeah, maybe blueberries need acidic soil, but who's telling you that the blueberry cannot make acidic soil itself?
Yeah, that's quite a big one. I've not noticed that yet. That's quite a big step.
Yeah, but what
we were talking about yesterday was like the because I was quoting how. For instance, you read a book and it says carrots like a soil of pH 6.8. It's like 6.8. Oh wow! You know, and then people believe that because it's written there. It must be true, and then they're worried because their pH is wrong. So they're doing all these expensive amendments, and it just makes it difficult. Mm. And when you realise that the soil biology, if you haven't been digging, because a lot of these statements are based on damaged soil.
Claro.
And
claro.
A lot of statements claro. Like, you know, if you've had white rot on your onions or club root on your brassicas, you mustn't grow them there for seven years or whatever it is, you know. Again, it's because the soil is damaged. You keep digging it and it's taking a long time to recover. So with no dig, again, it just opens the door to a lot of healing and a lot of possible easiness.
Yeah, and one thing that you said yesterday is like, because in my garden, when we got it, I told you it was completely unmanaged for many, many years. So the grass was not even grass as this, no, the wild grasses were about here.
And which is good.
Exactly. And this is what I liked. It's like when you find a field and you think that it's, oh my God, it's got wild grasses up until here. This must be horrible. No, it's full of life. Yeah. And those weeds are healing the soil, right? It was probably very disturbed soil to begin with.
Because I think that you had couch grass, didn't you?
Yes, yes, yes.
Elymas repens and that.
Yeah.
That's got fantastic roots that go
oh
into the
God.
Soil like
I
wire.
Know. Sometimes I pull one and it's like.
So they're really opening up the soil, which is probably quite damaged after many years of being cultivated. And
exactly.
So
don't think, this is one thing I teach is Germanic New Medicine, which I don't know if you know about, but it's oh my God, it's another field that Dr. Hammer, again, a German, and it's called Germanic New Medicine. He was an oncologist himself, but then through his observations he realized that cancer was not what he thought it was not what oncology told him it was, and then he started to discover how even something like cancer could just be a healing path of the body.
Oh wow.
Exactly. And his long story short, his studies, he was from the University of Tübingen in Germany. He presented the studies to his university. And they told him pretty much that he had to stop practicing medicine and he had to leave the country because he was under threat for the rest of his life. He lived in Spain for the rest of his life.
And how long ago was this?
When was Hammer? Dr. Hammer was in the 40s, I think.
What?
I have to check, yes.
I don't know if you've heard of this. This is amazing.
And then some of his colleagues who reviewed his work, some of his peers, actually gave statements later on, and they said that his findings were so on point and so irrefutable that if they accepted it, it was going to change medicine, and they couldn't do that.
Yeah. Well, at least they were honest about that.
Exactly. But then, if something like a cancer, which is the big C word, could actually be a way of the body healing itself.
Yeah. Then we just got to work out how to live with that and not let it kill you before it.
And then that also relates to weeds.
Weeds
are healing the soil. They're not an illness, no? And they treat it with a killing weed killer.
Yeah.
You're killing something that is actually healing the earth.
Although
it gives me goosebumps.
It's good not to have too many weeds. No, but this is good because then, you know, I look at my garden and I see very few weeds.
Yeah.
And we do very little weeding here, and I take that as a sign of encouragement because the soil is calm, it's happy, it's healthy, doesn't need to grow weeds from that point of view.
Exactly.
And
it doesn't need
it
the healing of the
vegetables.
Weeds because it's already healthy.
Yeah.
So it doesn't need the weeds to
Yeah, exactly.
This is incredible.
Yeah, it is. When you start thinking along these lines, there's a lovely saying linked to that. It's not what you know, it's what you understand. And that's why I mention that, like, when I'm teaching, because I think people can get overwhelmed by, oh, God, there's so much that I need to know. And there is. Yeah. But if you understand the principles, you can build block by block and gain these wonderful understanding. Look at those peas, you know, just how vibrant and healthy they are.
In June, on the 11th of June. My peas. Well, no, my peas are actually this high, but they don't have peas yet.
Oh, okay.
Maybe when I go back home, they have peas. But when I left 2 days ago, no peas yet.
This is quite an old English variety, Hurst Greenshaft, and it's a podding pea. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I can look at plants like this and I can almost see them glowing with health, aren't they?
Yeah, they do.
It's a really nice feeling. And that, when you make a lovely garden like this, that feeds you in many ways, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. That kind of feedback from the plants.
Absolutely. And then you get an amazing biome. And then an amazing health as well, because we can see. Like, I was seeing pictures of him from 5-6 years ago, and you look more vibrant now. I mean, you look good there, but you look even better now.
That's nice.
It's like the soil, it gets better with age.
Yeah, we're on an upward trajectory.
Tell us a little about what happened here, now that we're talking about pastures and weeds.
Yeah, absolutely.
What happened here? Because this was weeds, right?
Yeah, and just here, right where we're standing, actually on this line here, when I bought Homemakers in 2012, this was the fence, this was the perimeter. And over there, that was Homemakers, and I had roughly 1,000 square meters of crop ground, and the rest of the property was about 600 square meters. And then in 2021, December, I had the opportunity to buy this piece of land, which is 3,500 square meters. And first, you know what? I didn't want to. I just thought, I haven't got any spare time. How am I going to take that on?
Yeah.
And I felt overwhelmed. And then, yeah, I thought, this is crazy. If I don't buy it, someone else might. So I bought it. That was £42,000. I feel myself, it seems a lot of money, but it was so worth it.
No, it is totally worth it. It's probably the best investment ever. And it's not so much money as I would thought. I would thought it was more.
Well, so it's the same soil as here. It's nice soil. It's a loam over clay. So I'm very fortunate there.
It's
level ground. Mm. Yeah, that's the difference that you're seeing there. It's just where we've mown the weedy pasture just with the lawnmower. But so we first of all took the fence down. Then I step out here in January 2021. And what I'm met by is what you can see in the pasture over there, except it's January, but it's basically just weedy grass, if you like.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but it's like, how do I turn this into a vegetable garden? Mm. And now it is, but we've had to work really hard because this ground has a lot of bindweed. I was just wondering, you can even see it in the grass in places, if you know what it looks like. Like, that is bindweed.
Yes. And it crawls. It crawls everywhere.
And it has long, deep roots. Mm. And... oh, yeah, I'm seeing there's a lot.
Yeah.
At first you think that's just grass and clover, but actually there's a lot of bindweed.
Yeah, and it crawls into, it creeps into things.
Yeah, and it's coming up there a bit. But basically, this is a gardener's nightmare. And, you know, at first I was daunted by it. But thanks to no-dig and not disturbing the soil, I think that's a key part of it. So the soil, if it's not disturbed by digging or any kind of damage, it doesn't need to recover. Recover is an interesting word with soil, because it's recover. But it's also recover with weeds.
Yeah, recover.
And that's what we, again, going back, you know, that's what weeds are doing. They're helping the recovery process. So no dig, we still had bindweed for sure. That first year was just such hard work. We kept pulling it out or even using black plastic to cover it for a time. And then the following year, still more using a trowel to remove it out. But by the end of last year, which was second summer, it's almost gone.
It's almost gone. I have a lot of it as well in my garden.
Okay.
It comes from the neighbour. I think it's the same thing.
So I bet it is. And just very difficult because if your neighbour's not in control of it, it'll keep spreading in.
But it's not spread. I mean, sometimes I see it in the beds, but it's very easy to just like pick and go.
Well, yeah, with no dig, it pulls out more easily.
So easily. It's just really literally you pull and it comes out and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thrilled with how this is evolving now. In some ways, we're not quite at the same level. In other ways, we are actually. It's always interesting taking a new ground and seeing how things do compared to older ground. Mm-hmm. We've had some problems with wireworm there. That's little maggots living in the ground, but not too bad. And mostly, as you can see, things are doing very nicely here.
Potatoes are flowering.
Yeah. This is a new bed made in January this year. So 5 months ago, we put cardboard on the weedy ground, which was like that before. That's just from, it goes from mowing, it goes from being like that, which is lovely. I'm leaving that to like this. I'll keep a bit of clear space. And so cardboard on that, and you end up with compost on top of the cardboard. If any of your viewers don't know this process already, I mean, it's so simple. And under the cardboard, do we use the cardboard only once, you know?
Yeah, only once. And look at all the life.
Ants.
And eggs.
There's a lot of ants this year.
Yeah, me too.
Oh yeah, look at them. So yeah, they like it dry. They like the warmth on cardboard.
But I see ants, or I don't know, correct me, I may be wrong, but they don't do much damage to veggies. Or in
they, if you get a lot of them, if you had a big ants nest near to your plants, they secrete formic acid, which is a bit poisonous for roots. It's not too bad.
It's not too bad.
I mean,
but they don't eat. They don't tend to eat crops.
No.
No.
You know, that's how it is with pests. One is always trying to find the balance point, and you've got to accept that we're always going to have ants and slugs and woodlice. That's fine. Just need them to be not too many. But yeah, so we've been removing some of the dandelions and bindweed and couch grass that regrew, but it's not too much. And as you can see, we're getting some nice harvest.
It's so amazing.
I'm happy with that. That's year one. And then this is year three. No, that's, year three.
Of garlic.
Garlic and, yeah. This here, we've just finished turnips, we've just finished broccoli. So we've always got one or two empty beds for replanting. That's going to be summer lettuce, for example. And then here is the other way I use to, you know, go from weeds, basically. And this is using plastic just once.
Once.
You know, because I know many people don't like using plastic at all. For me, this is acceptable because it's plastic that you can reuse. So once these squash have finished their harvest in September, we'll take away the harvest, cut off the plants, put them on the compost heap and roll up the plastic and use it again if we need it. And it's just such a quick and easy way. There's a bit of cardboard there, but that's a bit misleading actually because it's only around the edge. And basically, the ground, you can see, so it's gone from that to that.
Well, it's gone from that.
Exactly, in 5 months.
In 5 months.
And we can see all the squash roots there, which is encouraging. We put not a lot of compost on, you know.
Doesn't look like it.
Yeah, it's maybe 5 centimetres. I hope it's enough, but I'm keen to use less if possible. But just because partly because I know not everybody has access to, but you know, compost is not perfect compost. This one had quite a lot of bits of wood in. So for any of you viewers, you know, don't be discouraged if you haven't got the perfect compost. Any decomposed organic matter can do, and it could be stuff you find just locally, like lying around with old tree leaves or whatever. Organic matter, basically.
Organic matter. Much better than fertilisers.
Yeah, exactly, because it's not fertiliser. And that's the other key understanding that, you know, like here, I put on all my compost in the before Christmas. So all the winter rain is washing through, and then some people have been told that that's not good because the nutrients wash out. That's
but in the fertilizers.
Totally, yeah, exactly. That's the one of the myths, you know, the myth that compost is like fertilizer and nutrients wash out of it. That people believe that, even in the organic movement. It's like, that's so wrong. Because if that was true, you would not get this exuberance. You know, look at these plants. They just got everything they need.
Of course. There is a difference between fertilizer and real compost. Compost you can lay in December, leave it the whole winter, and then plant in March.
Because the nutrients are not going anywhere, they're just staying there.
Whereas if you use fertilizer, the nutrients will go away with the rain.
Yeah. This is very good for water purity, it's good for plant growth because the nutrients are there. And then when it's warm enough for the plants to grow, and through no dig you've got all the mycorrhizal fragments network talking to the plants. It would be fascinating. Some people have done it. Actually, I think Germans again.
Yeah, of course.
putting in microphones in the soil. Have you heard about that?
I think I might have. In a documentary I watched about fungi and networks of fungi under the earth.
Right. Yeah, there's so much we don't know.
And they talk.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing to think that?
It is amazing.
I love it.
It is amazing because plants can talk from miles and miles and miles and miles and miles away.
Yeah. They're probably enjoying this, us talking here.
Yeah, of course. Hey, say hello to the plants. Say hello to YouTube.
I mean, that bed of beetroot. So again, early June, I've been picking that for 3 weeks now. I've had a huge amount of beetroot off it already.
This is early June, people. Yeah. It looks like it's already July here.
Oh. This beetroot, though, this is home seed again.
Ah, yes.
The vigour, it just blows me away. Mm. So I hadn't saved any beetroot seed last year. I saved it the year before, so it's a year old already. I haven't got any fridge to keep the seeds in. Mm-mm. So just in my house, you know, quite warm sometimes. Mm. And when I sowed the seed, I thought, oh God, is it going to come up? It's a year old, the seed's a year old already. And at the same time, I sowed some seed that I'd bought from somewhere else. And the herbicide seed all came up pretty much 100%.
And the with a lot of vigour.
By comparison, it did come up, but it's just more slow. And that's one of those, if you've got vital seed, it just grows faster. And I think that's a bit what's going on here.
Also because this seed will have the genetical information
from
this area.
Yeah, that's true.
That plant already existed there, so it knows what to expect. Okay, I'm going to the same place.
Yeah. Although, you know, to be fair, that's not quite true where I'm sowing it in the module trays in my greenhouse. Unless it had memory of that.
It's the same area.
It's the same environment, and climate and everything. Mm-hmm. But I did have a fleece over this bed. Again, that really helped. And you can see they're multi-sowing. I mean, this is just such a nice way of growing plants.
Ah, this is very interesting. So you grow more than one plant together.
I find with beetroot, up to four works really well.
Wow.
And then to harvest, you can see there's two nice sized ones here. You know, you can twist them out like that.
So easy.
So if you twist rather than pulling, that way this one actually I would take out. I don't think that's going to make it. But at least there's one left, and that one will get bigger.
And that's another thing that you do that is different. You don't dig out the plant. You just break it so all the roots stay inside.
Exactly. When we're clearing, always leave the roots in food for microbes. Nice way of thinking about it. Mm. In fact, you know, just think about things in a different way. Like when we plant these, you know, quite often with older gardeners, if I talk about multi-sowing, I show them then. I'll show them multi-sowing the seedlings in the cell, and then they say, so you separate these out when you put them in the ground? And I said, no. But they've been so much led to believe that you have to grow things in singles.
In singles.
And the way I look at it is, because this works so well, I'm thinking, well, they like going in the ground with their mates.
They do, of course. You know, I prefer to go in the ground with my mates.
Yeah, and when you're little, especially, you know, kids love hanging out together, don't you? You don't often see a child on its own somewhere. So, yeah, fascinating. And then kind of the reverse of multi-sowing is here with this rye, where this is my own seed. I grew it first last year.
Yeah, I saw your video when you made bread.
Oh, right. Crazy.
No need bread.
That's just two seeds of rye there.
Two seeds?
Has grown, yeah.
All of that comes from two seeds?
I mean, that's probably a one-seeder there. We're getting about 15 stems, I reckon, from each seed. So, yeah, you don't need many seeds.
How many kilos of rye do you get from this patch?
Well, I don't know yet.
How much do you get last
rain.
Week? Yeah, well.
Depending on the weather, maybe 20 kilos.
20 kilos last year?
I'd be happy with that. Oh. Last year I got from actually that area there where you can see the onions and the carrots. That happens to be where I grew the rye last year. And that gave me six big loaves of bread, which means about 3 kilos.
Grain. Half a kilo per bread.
Yeah.
Wow.
But this is a lot of work. It's all hand harvest, so it makes the bread's expensive.
Expensive in labor.
Yeah. Expensive is the wrong word, isn't it? But a lot of time.
Yeah.
Very joyful process. This polytunnel has been here for 4 years. Mm-hmm. This structure, before that was another one here. So this is now the year 11 of growing food in this place. And again, you know, not much rotation. So what I do actually is these cucumbers, I grew them at the other end last year. This was tomatoes. So I do alternating tomatoes and cucumbers. And these, when do you think these were sown?
Olga, you said yesterday, but was it like yesterday?
Yeah, it was the 17th of
April.
That's it. That's the date I recommend.
Crazy.
Roughly mid-April. And then we planted them here, transplanted 17th of May. So that's, what's today, the 11th of June, 25 days ago that these went in the ground as plants.
Less than a month.
Yeah.
And look at the size of it.
And the again, they just look so good, don't they? They look so happy.
Yeah, they do.
And we you know, just surface mulching, it's really simple. We do hardly any weeding in here. Mm-mm. I do no feeding. Again, that's time saving. Yeah, pretty much everything I'm doing, the precise methods I'm using is about saving time. And with the cucumbers, I do a special thing where I take off every second cucumber so I don't let all of them grow. I find that way with organic growing, where I'm not pumping them full of fertilizers. Mm. That enables me to get a nice big cucumber succeeding without the plant having
to. So you remove every other, like when you have two cucumbers, then you remove it and you leave just one.
Yeah, that's it. I was doing it just this morning. So there's one, then I took this one out and leave that one, then take that one out and so on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But my tomatoes are not looking so happy. And actually, that's one slight problem I have in here. It's a little bit too hot by day.
And they curl.
Causing the leaf roll, yeah. Mm. And I can live with that because my main value in here for the market garden is the winter salad. In winter, we you know, and people love that.
Yeah.
Tomatoes, ironically, although everybody loves tomatoes, if you're selling them, you make no money at all. You know, the price is low. It's the base price is set by horrible hydroponic growing. You know, pretty much slave labor, I think, as well.
Mm. So. And zero nutrition.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You're growing things in water.
Yeah. These tomatoes in there, and we saw the leaf roll. And then in the greenhouse, the comparison.
This greenhouse is so beautiful.
Yeah, it's like, but you know what? It nearly blew down 3 years ago. The whole structure was swaying in the wind. And I wrote to the people who made it and who designed it, and at first they were disbelieving, and then I said, look, you've got to do something about this, and it could be embarrassing for you because I've got a big following on social media. And then they arrived with these braces, and the guy put them, it's the guy who designed the greenhouse, actually, he came. He'd made these specially.
Very nice.
And then afterwards I heard that they'd offered these to everybody who'd got one of these greenhouses. So I think I helped them out in the end by pointing this out.
Of course.
It just wasn't stable quite. Mm. But it's brilliant. The energy in here is amazing. Yeah, these lettuce, these were sown about 10 days ago. 9 days, 8 days ago. Yeah, it's just like, wow.
This is a week ago.
And we pricked them out. So this is my summer lettuce planting for my salad bags. But if you look at these tomatoes, you see that they haven't got the same leaf roll. So that, you know, the same sowing day, everything's the same except just the different temperature in here.
It's not so hot here because this
I think it's more that it's warmer at night because polytunnels get quite cold at night, and we'd have cold nights until
recently.
Because
they lose a lot of heat, whereas glass doesn't so quickly.
Yeah, exactly, and also the wood and the brick walls at the bottom. But it's been down to 7 degrees in the polytunnel recently, you know, so in here it's maybe 12.
That's too cold.
Yeah. And then I see it in the melons too. I mean, look at this, you know, for the 11th of June, I've already got, I think this is a record.
Yeah, it is.
It's already at the top. That's how much it grew in a day pretty much, because I twisted it around, you know, it's growing like that much in a day. And then I don't let the melons develop until the plants get a little bit bigger, so.
So when do you decide that it's time to let the melons develop?
Probably about knee height.
Okay.
That will then mean the melon will be quite close to the ground, which is okay. But it also means the plant gets more growth behind it before it starts this hard work of growing melons as well. Because it's same with tomatoes. They're doing so much, aren't they, at the moment? They're growing and they're producing fruit and they're trying to ripen fruit even and doing that all at once.
It's a lot of work. Well done, guys.
Yeah. Something I discovered only last week was, I was quite shocked actually, that I had a guy here volunteer. I do take occasional volunteers, but not too many, because actually, for me, it can be quite a lot of work, because it basically means I'm training people, yeah. But I learned things from these guys too, and something I learned from him was, he'd been going around working on a lot of market gardens, organic market gardens, all over southern UK mostly, and he said none of those guys are making compost.
So they're all buying the compost?
Yeah, they're buying it in, which is fine. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with buying a compost.
But why not make it?
Yeah, why not make it? What's going on here? And he said, well, if he said that to them, they say, well, we haven't got time.
But does it really take that much time, Charles?
Well, not if you get organised. You know, this is it. So I think it's motivation as well. And must be some kind of, there needs to be more knowledge about the fantastic benefit of making your own, the microbes in here, because the compost they're buying often are these town compost, the black, it's very good. Black ones, and they're really black because they've been very hot, and killed most of the life, actually. Mm. You have to tick these boxes, no pathogens, no weeds.
No nothing, no life.
Suddenly, whereas this is the opposite. And I can actually, though, this time of year, get it hot enough. Like here, we're up to 55 centigrade, quite close to the edge, actually. Mm. And that's because I line the sides. You know, this is, again, this is myth. Yeah, everyone's told you must have
open air,
sides. Slatted sides to your compost heaps to let the air in. Mm-hmm. No. And nobody's questioning that.
No.
But it doesn't make sense if you think about it. You don't want air flowing through your compost tube. It's going to cool it down.
Because it won't heat.
Yeah, and dry it out at the side as well. So with this method, I'm finding the heat goes nicely quite through, actually. This is obviously bigger than most people would want, but it's the same principle.
This is a scale much bigger because you are growing to sell. But for a homemade, we have probably ours are a quarter of them, of these.
Right, okay, well, a bit like that Dalek bin I showed you yesterday.
Yeah.
And you can make nice compost in
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely, it's beautiful.
And this here, this is our peak time of year, because 6th of June, so that's 5 days ago, we started this one.
5 days ago.
Wow, we've already got that much, yeah. It's helped by my neighbour, actually. He was clearing out his ditch, and I've trained him, he brings up his wheelbarrow and drops
this
it.
This is a good idea, ask your neighbours to give you, because usually they don't know what to do with it. In Germany, you have to bring it to the local recycling centre.
Right.
But you might save them a trip.
Exactly.
So well, don't go. I'll save you a trip. Just give it to me.
Yeah.
And then.
And I'll just say for your viewers, I don't know if I've got any examples here. It's totally fine to. Oh, yeah, that was bindweed. It's dried off now. It's totally fine to compost weeds. All weeds you can compost, including bindweed roots, mare's tail, everything we put in here. And also all the. A lot of stuff you're told you're not meant to, like citrus peel, all that sort of stuff.
We put everything. Brilliant. We put everything.
Yeah. Tomatoes, potatoes. You know, again, people have been so misled, really, and made to think it's difficult, and it's just not.
I think making compost is one of the things that daunts people the most. Because I get this question a lot. It's like, teach us how to make compost. And I say,
wow.
It really is just throw things in a bucket and wait for it to become
An important principle is to have air in the heap. So that's where the little bits of wood like this are really good, but you just want them in small pieces.
Wood.
That's long enough. Mm-hmm. And that's a bit of bramble, actually. That's old bramble, perfect.
To create some pockets of air.
Yeah, that's it. And then you've got, so that's the brown, that's the green. And this, if you just loaded your compost heap with leaves like that, it is going to go soggy and airless. Yeah. So that's not good. So that's why you want the bit of brown. Paper's good, cardboard, anything fibrous and that was wood once. Then you've got things like, there's a weed stem that's, you know, that something like that's probably half green and half brown.
Because it's got a lot of fibre.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you just have to get to know your materials really. And I do it roughly 3/4 by volume green, 1/4 by volume brown, mm-hmm. just very roughly.
I don't know. I follow a principle. Let's see if I am right. We literally, because we don't have so much access to massive amounts, and the pile does go down a lot. It's a little bit discouraging that you have a pile here and then a month later it's here and you're like, oh my God. But what I do is, this is more by eye, but if it starts to smell, I know I need more brown. Would that be a good method? Sometimes when it becomes a bit smelly, like rotting, I go like, this needs a bit of brown. And then I throw.
I can see where you're coming from. I would say 3 or 4 days before it's smelly.
Okay.
If you get what I mean. Because that's saying you've gone to the anaerobic, slightly swamp-like conditions.
Yeah. We've had that.
It sounds like, as a rule, you could probably add a bit more brown, even paper.
That's what I do, because we have a lot of access to paper. So when that happens, or when I start to think that it's going to happen, then I shred a lot of paper, put it in. Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. That's a good method. Watering really is something that I never know if I'm doing right or not.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm the same as well. I've probably just got a bit more experience. So
yeah, a little bit.
Well, it's, you know, just look at, like, we've never watered these onions, for example.
Not at all.
We've had a month of dry weather now, not at all. We've watered the spring onions up there because they need to grow a bit faster and bushier. I haven't watered that sweet corn yet, for example. Mm-hmm. But we've watered the bean plants that are growing up the poles just to get them going. But now that they've got going, I can see they're growing really fast. We stop watering. So for me, I was going to say rule, but I don't really like that word. But, you know, one understanding is make sure your plants have got established. If you do transplants, give them some water so that they can stay alive while they're getting their roots into the ground. And that means you might need to water them the day you put them in and the following day, even maybe the third day after that, if the sun's really hot. Mm-hmm. But if it's cloudy weather, you probably didn't even need to do the second and third watering. So it's always related to weather. Mm-hmm. But once you see new plants growing, generally I like to leave them alone to get their roots down.
So once you transplant, usually I always give them water when I transplant.
Right.
And then you wait, and when you see them, that they start to grow, yeah, that means that the roots have
exactly
taken.
Yeah, and they can look after themselves for quite a while, because you actually want that root system to go down and team up with the microlife in the soil as well.
Because if you water too much, the roots will stay in the surface, right?
There is that. There is that. Do you know, it's a really interesting thing I heard recently from, I work with the Royal Horticultural Society in the UK, Wisley, their headquarters garden in near London. And they've got a very traditional, meaning chemical, orchard there of apple trees. And it's been managed in a very traditional way with lots of fertilizer, pesticide and drip irrigation. And they've decided to change this because they're going a bit more eco now. You know, great project, actually. And they were wondering how difficult it would be to get these apple trees out. And they're big trees and they're probably 50 years old. And they found they could almost push them over because they actually had a chain between two small tractors and they just drove along either side of the row and all the trees fell over because the roots were so shallow.
No.
And it's a bit that thing, drip irrigation and fertilizer, you know. The roots didn't have to do any work. But I think that with these vegetables, they're rooting much more deeply than we imagine. And people often say to me things like, well, surely lettuce doesn't root much, you know, it's all in the surface. And I really don't agree with that, because sometimes in really hot weather we're not watering lettuce every day and the plants are doing okay. Wow. And they must be getting
they
down there,
and
also for nutrition as well. But that's enabled by the mycorrhizal network, the mycelia, which themselves are already deep down. So if you know, with no digging, you've got plant roots teaming up with this fungal network, which is already deep rooting, if you like. So that means that, you know, your plant quite quickly is able to look after itself in a very impressive fashion. And, you know, you've been commenting on how fast things grow, but I think that's another factor. But with the watering, then in really dry conditions like that, we just started watering, like the peas we looked at. When they start to crop, or like these peas here, you know, that's when it's worth giving them water.
When you start seeing flowers, right?
When you start seeing flowers, exactly.
Then it's good to water, because then you want
It's not that the plant
fruit
would die if you didn't, but no, more that the bit we want to eat is now growing and we can increase the harvest by giving water at this point.
So that's an excellent point, especially now that it's not raining anywhere.
Yeah, I
wonder why.
Yeah.
Then people don't fret, like Charles says, just establish the plant. Once established, leave it alone mostly.
Yeah.
And when you see the flowers, then start to give water.
Yeah. Or if it's salad plant, then you will be giving more generally water. Like the lettuce here, we water maybe twice a week, but not every day. Another nice little principle is wait until you see the surface is dry before you water. So you don't worry if the surface of where you're growing doesn't always look wet. That can be good.
See,
actually,
this is not wet.
Exactly, but it's like almost like a mulch on top. And that makes a kind of capillary boundary, and it means that the moisture below can't evaporate upwards. So actually having a bit of dry compost on top like that is a mulch.
It stops the
And then if
water.
We go down a bit, we have actually been watering here.
Yeah.
You'd hardly know. I think it's the roots are so vigorous, they suck most of that water out. But there's some moisture now. And usually by this point, in fact, if it had been raining, we'd see little roots all near the top, because plant roots are very opportunistic. But again, I mean, look at this. This is no dig and dry conditions, which mean the soil is more firm and I can keep on putting my finger down.
Which is amazing.
And keep going down.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a mixture of soil and compost that's been all created by soil life from the annual. We're putting on about that much a year of new compost.
That's another thing, right? So at the end of the cropping season, you put about 5 centimeters of soil?
No, not even.
Not even.
It might look that when it first goes on.
Yeah.
But then I measure it when it's settled, because I think that's a more true measure. And it's about 3 centimetres.
And that's
two and a half to three.
And that's it.
That's it for the whole year.
For the whole year.
So, like here, after these peas, I might be planting celery or beetroot or whatever, and we're not putting any more compost on in the summer. So it's a once a year application, and that links to how compost holds the nutrients. It's not like fertilizer; it's a long term food for soil.
Long term investment.
Yeah. And just to say about the watering, come back to that. There's two more things. One is, I think generally people have been made to worry about water and plants need water, you know, and they overwater. And so I would say probably for most of you listening, you could probably water a bit less and you might be surprised.
So. I think so. I think most people overwater instead of underwater.
Yeah.
And
even if you see a plant, a sign that a plant really needs water, you go out on a sunny afternoon and the leaves are wilting. But don't worry. You can remedy that and you can water it in the sunshine. So if you go out in bright sunlight at 2 p.m. in the afternoon and you see some plants that are obviously struggling a bit, give them some water. And we've been told that you shouldn't do that because it burns the leaves. Totally false. And what can I say? Because even, do you know, 2 weeks ago in the British magazine, The New Scientist, there was an article saying, oh, we've just discovered this is not true. After all, we've done some scientific research.
It's the same for skin. Many, they say you have to put a lot of sun protection because when you have wet skin, it will burn your skin because you have droplets of water on your skin. Doesn't happen.
That's ridiculous.
Doesn't happen.
I don't even use sun cream.
No, we don't. And we don't recommend it. It's toxic.
What exactly?
It's toxic. Yeah. It's toxic for you. It's toxic for the environment. It's toxic for plants, for the sea, for the animals.
Yeah.
No, and you need the sun. Hello.
Vitamin D.
Everything. Yeah. And how happy you feel when you're under the sun. This is a big topic in my channel and my community, to receive the sun.
That. Well, on Facebook last year, I had a visit from a couple of lovely Irish men about in their early 40s, the happy pair.
Yes, I saw it. Yeah. And they were like all without their tops.
That's it.
Yes.
And I joined them in a photo and I didn't have a shirt on either.
Yes.
And so one of my followers says, oh, Charles, I hope you were wearing sunscreen. And I said, well, no, actually, because, you know, I just said, well, I like the vitamin D, in fact.
Yeah.
And then that provoked a huge the comments. And one lady said, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist.
Wow.
Oh, I'm so sorry that I've unfollowed you. And I'm really sorry I bought your books. And yeah, she was really upset.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry for you, too.
Well, it's such a pity, though, isn't it? You know, she's been so misled.
Mm. And why do you take it personally?
Yeah, true, actually. Yeah.
If Charles does that, good for Charles for Charles.
I'd like to think that she'll have reflected on that and, you know.
Hopefully. But this is the thing. Why do you take personally with what another person does, especially a person that has nothing to do with you?
No, but I think that's because she probably really looked up to me. You know, she's my follower and really and suddenly realizes that I'm a zero. I've gone from hero to zero. And that's a shock for her. So, you know, I'd like to think that she had a shock and then sort of maybe
thought about it.
Yeah. Didn't throw the books away.
Well, she will lose. It will be her loss. It's her loss because, it will be her loss.
But it was an eye-opener to me to realise, how much of this misunderstanding. It goes back to myths and misunderstandings, really, doesn't it?
We work in this industry of alternative health and I mean, I've been 12 years, so I don't get a lot of pushback anymore because I think people know me very well. If you are against anything I talk about, you would have stopped watching me 5 years ago. So I don't get a lot of it. But the community that talks about these things, the pushback, especially people taking things personally that have nothing to do with.
But some pushback is good, I think, because that shows that people who are not thinking like we do, at least they're here, watching, listening, I hope. Yeah. You know, I want to connect with those people because I feel that there's benefits that we can share. And I'm not saying we're right on everything because nobody is.
Just
to think about things, you know, question things more and get curious and start wondering, could this really be true? Because I get a lot of comments or questions like, and it'll start by, somebody told me, I have heard that or I have read that. And I just think, well, so what?
So what?
But they've clearly believed it. But why?
Have you tried it?
Why did you believe that?
Have you tried it?
What was the reason given? Was there a reason given? Usually there's no reason given. It's just a statement. Mm. And those are the kinds of ones that need to be questioned where there's no reason given. You've got it. And that goes back to pure information is nothing. You've got to have an understanding. of why it's the case, and that's what really helps and leads to a better future.
Oh, Charles, I feel we could be here absolutely forever. I don't know if there is anything else you want to share, or you are happy, because we could be here 2 days talking. I mean, I've been here 2 days already.
Well, should we give your viewers a rest?
And it's never ending. I just want more. But thank you so much, Charles, for being so open as well, for being so open-minded and also so freeing to people. I think what you do is give people more freedom.
Great. Well, that cheers me up, because that's what I want. Thank you for, you know, helping it to happen and for creating this beautiful video.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you. Thank you.
Gracias por escuchar Viaje a la Nueva Historia, la reunión de la tribu, conmigo, Jimena de la Serna. Este podcast y el 99% de mi contenido te lo ofrezco completamente gratis, dependiendo solamente del apoyo de seguidores como tú. Si quieres apoyar este viaje a llegar lejos, te puedes suscribir a mi canal, a mi blog y podcast en jimenadelaserna.com. Recuerda que toda acción, por pequeña o anónima que parezca, tiene un efecto mariposa inimaginable. Si cada que recibes una pieza de contenido mía que te inspire o ayude, la compartes con una sola persona de tu círculo, estarás pavimentando el camino del viaje al nuevo mundo y la reunión de la tribu será imparable. Gracias por viajar juntos. Nos vemos en el siguiente episodio.